Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We welcome back to St. Louis on the Air Dr. Peter Raven, longtime president of the Missouri Botanical Garden, the current garden president emeritus. His full-time job may be over, but he still pays full-time attention to conservation and environmental issues facing our planet. He joins us just a few days after his 80th birthday. So a belated happy birthday to you, Dr. Raven.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
It's pleasure is all ours. Are you keeping pretty busy these days?
I am. I'm very busy on the board of the National Geographic Society and with plant conservation. I'm trying to work on my biography and working on a checklist of the plants of India, so I'm keeping very busy.
Well, retirement has given you a little more time maybe to do some of the things and catch up on things you may have wanted to do before, huh?
No budgets, no personnel problems.
What in all of the various areas in which you're involved today, what are the areas that are receiving most of your attention and most of your concern?
I spend a lot of time worrying about interactions between faith and science and how people can be help to understand the dilemma that the world is facing now and to begin to deal with it more effectively.
Faith and science. Just elaborate on that for me.
You know, people aren't really very often jarred out of their ordinary daily activities by being shown more numbers about how awful something is. But if you can put it on an ethical level, and I think that's essentially what happened in Earth Day in 1970, if you can put it more on an ethical level and realize that not that things that are happening have a big effect on our own lives, let alone the lives of our children and grandchildren, and that there's really a reason for doing something about it, then you might be able to get somewhere. Both Catholics and evangelical Christians and others understand that we're meant to do good for the poor and not to just be selfish for ourselves. And that helps a lot in thinking about environmental problems because almost anyone you can think about injures the poor more than it injures anybody else.
Do you think that message is taking, if I can put it that way?
Well, I think the Pope's encyclical of last year was important in that, and I don't think evangelical Christians have ever really varied from that. They truly believe that if what you do for the poor, you do for God, and that keeps them going too. So I think that's at least one important angle to take. It's interesting how people have accepted more and more the scientific conclusion that global warming is not only a reality, but that human actions are the major factor driving it, because they've gradually come to understand that and accept it. I think partly there because you can see what's going on around you. Walk outside.
Right. It doesn't, you don't have to walk far to sort of catch on. But you know, Dr. Raven, one of the things that seems to me to be conspicuously absent from all this political dialogue we've been hearing today, and it's been all over the place, not a whole lot of it has been expressed with about concern for the environment.
No, I posted a website on that on Andy Revkin's site at the New York Times. It seems that the issues that we're talking about are really archaic in a large sense. I mean, there are three times as many people in the world now as there were when I was born. The United States is the wealthiest nation on Earth. We spend as much on defense as the next 12 nations put together. People are better off here than they are in any other industrialized country, and yet we keep yakking about how to make ourselves better off. Well, we're already over the top in terms of our use of world's resources, and what we really ought to be trying to figure out is how to capitalize on our diversity, which is so magnificent, and by capitalizing on that, be a world leader in bringing people together instead of separating people or instead of figuring out where we have to wage little battles to satisfy ourselves and to get back to something theoretical, which is let's get much better off than we are. Let's go back to the good old days, which is really a waste of time. And it's a very selfish and uninformed waste of time. So it's a poor thing.
I think the politicians might begin to give it a little more attention when the water is lapping at the doorstep in Miami, Florida, and when some islands in the Pacific no longer exist.
Yeah, the best scientific estimate is that the sea level will go up about 6 feet in the remainder of this century. And when you figure that the average elevation of Fort Myers, Florida is 2 feet or Coral Gables, then you can understand that we got something going on. And yet, of course, people are pushing down into the tidal zones to build shopping centers in order to raise more taxes for their communities. Those are really deep issues, but they're not issues. It's very hard to motivate people to vote for you by talking about things like that. Jimmy Carter found out all about that some time back, and I think it's just a fact. People want to hear that by doing something, they can be better off and richer and wealthier and have more opportunities.
I've forgotten the number, but it's impressive, and you probably know it or know about it. And that is, how many of the world's population live along coastlines?
About 50%.
50%.
More than 50%. Yeah, cities in close range of coastlines.
There is another element to this that people don't talk about. I've read about it in one or two books, and that is the number of refugees that will be created. And if we think what's going on now in the Middle East and in Southern Europe is a problem, when the waters begin to rise, the number of people displaced is going to be just gigantic.
Sure, look at Bangladesh. Exactly. India already has a sturdy fence along the border with Bangladesh. You know, much of the country will be gone. But the government of Vietnam, for example, Vietnam is one of the very few rice exporters in the world. And the government there figures that 1/3 of their agricultural productivity will be underwater as the next few decades go by. China is taking steps to take care of all three of its coastal industrial areas, because their estimate is that they'll be 30% underwater soon. And if you don't begin to think in those terms, and if you don't begin to think in terms of needing peace all over the world, we clearly aren't going to get anywhere. And that's kind of why I stress in my own actions and thoughts these days the ethical perspective. The United States is not an island floating around somewhere out in the air. It's part of a world that's really depleting its resources awfully rapidly, and we need to deal with them awfully cleverly if we want to find sustainability.
And one of the things we're going to have to do with diminishing resources and with the changes as a result of climate change is feed the people of the world. There are a lot of them going hungry. Where are we now with regard to that? I know it's an area of interest to you with your plant.
Well, the world population's about 7.4 billion right now. We add 250,000 people a day. Footprintnetwork.org estimates that we're using about 156% of everything that's there. 800 million of the 7.4 billion are chronically hungry or malnourished. About half the people in the world live on less than $2 a day. And Oxfam recently calculated, the very effective British charity, that about 62 people in the world have about half of the wealth. So we've got to find ways to bring people closer together and to build bridges between people, not as a matter of charity from kind of a fortified castle, if that's what we want to look at ourselves as being, but as a matter of real survival and sustainability.
Are we anywhere near the capacity to be able to feed all these people, the people who are so great, so much in need?
You know, we're not feeding them now and adding 250,000 a day. I mean, sub-Saharan Africa is 900 million people right now, sub-Saharan Africa. In the next 34 years, it's predicted to grow from 900 million to 2.4 billion. And yet Africa is the hardest off of any place in the world, with depleted soils and all the rest. Are we going to be able to feed them? Well, of course, it's a matter of getting food around. It's a matter of applying the best technology. It's a matter of helping other people to reach a kind of a stability. We use about 2 times our own capacity in the United States to maintain our standard of living, which means we draw a lot from the rest of the world. But what we've got to do is build on our own marvelous diversity and begin to reach out to the rest of the world in a way that really only we can do.
Well, can you just take that one step beyond? What can we do? We can reach out, but we still have to put food in people's bellies.
Yes. We have to spend some of our money on it. We have to understand that our own stability depends on other people's stability. So we have to begin to invest in it. We have to realize that if we're 156% of using the world's capacity right now, which footprintnetwork.org can substantiate that we're not, and if we use two times as much as we have to support our standard of living, that there's some kind of problem there as we go into the future. I mean, Adlai Stevenson in 1965 made the analogy of spaceship Earth. Mm-hmm. And he said, we can't go on in a world divided between rich and poor, well-to-do and not well-to-do, which is by no means a matter of communism, but it's a matter of realizing where we are in the world and how we can get along with other people, encourage them, use some of our resources to support them, and look at our own standard of living as a way of helping other people.
Well, you know, that brings me to the notion, it's one thing to think about helping people in other parts of the world. Let's stick with hunger for the moment. We've got an awful lot of people here in this country who do not eat properly, do not eat well, and do not eat the way they should. And we're not doing an awful lot about them here. What about solving that problem before going to India or sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, I've often said that, you know, the problem with talking as I've been talking and agreeing with what you just pointed out is that we don't really take care of the poor in our own cities. I mean, St. Louis, which has been such a wonderful place for me over the past 45 years, and which I dearly love and which is clearly home, we have a very bad racial problem, needless to say. We have a very bad problem with ignoring the poor, and we find it very difficult to pull ourselves together to do anything about it. And of course, when you look at the whole metro area, there are different problems everywhere. Getting serious about our own obligation to one another and building a country that really does take care of its own diversity and take care of its own poverty is a good thing, is a very good thing, and is essential. On the other hand, we got to remember in doing that that we're drawing the resources from all over the world. So we've got to somehow get beyond that. Really, it sounds totally romantic or whatever, but we've got to get the love that we feel for the members of our own family out to all the members of the community, and then far beyond that to all the people in the entire world if we want to reach a kind of a stability for this planet. Otherwise, we'll go down the drain with hot spots and cold spots and hunger and wealth, and that's, I don't think, what anybody really wants, but the question is, are they willing to do something about it?
Well, given the social conditions you've just described for our area, you've been at the Botanical Garden, been in St. Louis for more than four decades. Have things really changed very much since your arrival here in this regard?
Well, 1971, when I came, I think things were still going downhill from outflight from the city and so forth. But most of the time I've been here, things have gotten better. Our Botanical Heights development near the garden, the Cortex development, the military mapping agency staying inside the city, IKEA building here, and a lot of other things have helped to overcome the sort of urban sprawl that's characterized the area from the 50s onward, and which is clearly a bad thing. It eats up farmland, it eats up resources, it eats up the beauty of the area, and it doesn't really get anything in return. Two-thirds of the world's population, 80% of the world's population, will soon be in cities of a million or more. And we've got to get much better ways of planning those cities, of designing them, and of recognizing their dependency on the countryside around them if we want to improve and maintain the lives of people in the future.
During the more than four decades, 45 years, I guess, now that we're talking about, that you've been here, what would you point to in looking back as the most notable advancements in your field?
In science or in—
In science, but I'm thinking of the world of botany and conservation.
Oh, well, in botany and biology generally, it's been the sequencing of nucleic acids like DNA, like the whole human genome and the placing and understanding of genes within the genome and how they affect us and how much we depend on genetics. That's been unbelievable. in the field of neuroscience, there have been unbelievable strides over that period of time in understanding how the brain functions and how the whole nervous system functions and how we really are what we are. A recent, very important development in which Dr. Gordon of Washington University played a major role, of course, is the recognition of our complete dependence on the bacteria that live within us and the important role that they play in regulating our own metabolism. And then we have epigenetics, which is a fancy word, but it shows that some characteristics can be inherited and some survivors of horrible experiences can be marked genetically by that permanently. All those things are changing. Well, and then we should say the kind of thing that saved Jimmy Carter's life, the realization that you don't solve cancer necessarily by hammering on the genes that are causing it or on the malfunctioning genes that are causing it, but you can get back to it from the environment that the cancer is occurring in. In every way, the last 45 years have been a golden era of science. We've gained probably more knowledge in the last 15 years than we have in all the world before that, in the entire history of the world. And science will help us a lot. Of course, doubting scientific conclusions like global climate change or evolution is a complete distraction and a waste of time, or inoculations is a complete distraction and a waste of time in a country that ought to know better.
One of the things I wanted to get to with regard to this are the plant sciences, which I know is something that you've been interested in. Certainly a lot of research being done at Botanical Garden. We've got the Danforth Plant Science Center here. But I have in my notes here that one-third of the world's plant species are in danger of extinction. What is that going to mean if it even begins to happen to a large degree?
Well, I have to divide the answer into two parts. I was one of the two people that Bill Danforth called together when we started the Danforth Plant Science Center, and I'm delighted that they agreed to accept that name for it. It's done a lot and is certainly using the most modern methods possible now to improve food. We've got to improve the food supply on the one hand. One-third of the world is either crops or grazing, and that's driven a lot of species to extinction in itself. There are a lot of species in danger. I'm the head of the board of a group called the Center for Plant Conservation, which is a very important group in saving the plants of the United States by putting their seeds in seed banks or by growing them in botanical gardens. And although the figure that you've given, a third of the species of plants, maybe even a half of the species of plants, are in danger of extinction in the wild by the end of this century, global warming playing one major role in that, we can, because they're plants, put seeds aside, grow them, and save them in ways that are much, much more difficult and expensive to contemplate for animals. Each vertebrate animal that's kept in the zoos of the world probably costs several hundred thousand dollars a year to maintain in zoos, you know, to keep it healthy. And whereas plant species can be saved for much less than that. And of course, the message is that we ought to save them, we ought to save our crops, we ought to save the diversity of our crops, and we ought to save the wild plants of the world, about 400,000 species, in a form where they'll still be used for the future. Ed Wilson, though, the great Harvard biologist, has stated that the extermination of species of plants and animals, causing them to disappear permanently from the face of the earth, is probably the single sin for which our descendants will be least likely to forgive us. Everything depends on plants and animals, organisms in the earth, from the control of the atmosphere to the control of the topsoil to the purity of the water to our food to many of our medicines and on and on. And if we're driving very large numbers of them to extinction, which we are, it's time for us to begin to pay attention. And of course, I'm very proud that the garden plays a major role in that worldwide and that Peter Weiss Jackson, my successor, is such an ardent plant conservationist. But our zoo and the Science Center and the other institutions here play a major role. We have the best, greatest concentration of plant scientists in St. Louis of any community in the United States. And the research that we're doing here, by improving agriculture and helping it to be highly productive on the smallest and therefore most efficient pieces of land possible will leave a chance in the rest of the world for species to be saved in nature or artificially, as I've described them.
Yeah, you mentioned medicine a moment ago, and many people may not realize that plant science plays a pivotal role in many of the medications that are in use today and many that haven't even been thought of yet or discovered.
Most people don't realize that two-thirds of the people in the world, and here you would include most of the people in China and India, depend directly on plants for their medicines. There is no recourse. Sometimes people say, well, are Chinese medicines any good? And I inevitably reply to that, no, the Chinese are incredibly silly and stupid. They've been using the same medicines for thousands of years with no effect. Isn't that strange? But seriously, one quarter of all the medicines that we use in the United States come originally from plants, a number of them still from plants. Another quarter come directly from bacteria or fungi and are made into medicine. So even here, more than half of our medicines have a natural origin. And of course, we've only looked at a very small proportion of the plants on Earth to see what they might have, which is another example of why it's such folly to be driving them to extinction so rapidly.
With every plant or every species that does go into extinction, there may also go a cure for cancer or for Alzheimer's disease or whatever.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Or a better source of food.
Right. One area that I'm sure you've given some thought to and I suspect are concerned about is something we talk about a lot here. And that is there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of enthusiasm among today's students for the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and math. You see this as a major problem ahead?
I do see it as a major problem, and I think that anything we can do to correct it will be repaid in the future. There are a number of significant efforts in that area here in St. Louis and nationally, and I think we need to keep right after it. One of the basic reasons that it's important is that people understanding the scientific method, what science really means, will not start worshiping science, but they'll stop going around saying ignorant things like global climate change isn't really happening, or humans aren't really playing a major role in it, or that evolution does not exist, or many other things which limit our ability to react sensibly in the world as it exists now. We've got to espouse science and a scientific method because it's one objective thing. Now, one of the things that I found out at the National Academy of Sciences and in other bodies to which I belong is what an important thing science is for bringing people together and for helping common understanding between countries and the like. But in order for that to happen, we have to understand what it really means and that it's not just a series of opinions given by commentators, but rather a series of serious conclusions. And that's one of the many reasons that it's very important to educate our children in science as well as we possibly can.
Why do you think, we only have a little over a minute left, why do you think many young people are not drawn to this world?
I'm not sure how true that is. Part of it is that it's not well taught necessarily. Teaching it experimentally in a hands-on way is going to help them to be drawn to it. And I think encouraging and recruiting first-class teachers is an important element in the whole process.
You've got a major meeting coming up here in St. Louis on the 28th and 29th. The Global Partnership for Plant Conservation Conference is taking place. What's likely to come of that in a minute?
Peter Weiss Jackson, my successor, is the head of that organization. He's done a great job of drawing together people from all over the world, and I think it's encouraging one another, thinking about methods and trying to find ways to do better.
This is part of that conversation you want to see going, an international kind of collaborative, if you will.
Absolutely so. Individual respect and love all over the world is really the only hope that we have.
What's number one on the agenda for this conference, do you know?
I think looking at just methods at a national and international level in preserving plants better, more effectively.
All righty. Well, Dr. Peter Raven, it's always such a great pleasure to talk to you. You know so much and you express it so well, articulate it so well. It's a great opportunity to hear you speak.
Thank
you
so much. What fun to be here.
Fun is on our part. Thank you so much, sir. Great to see you again. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Kim Oswald, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis on the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council. That is a state agency. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.